Hey, y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's the Skull Horton Show. Should be a good one today. Ray McGovern's going to be back. Talk about Ukraine. The new Cold War. That's why I do this show, you know. Because it's so obvious. It doesn't have to be this way. You know? I don't know what can be done about it. But yeah. No, this thing they teach you about how history is just, you know, the way it had to be. It's all just inevitable. Yeah, no. That's not my experience. Not my lifetime. All I've seen is a lot of bad decisions in a row. So anyway, I don't think you could come up with a better example than getting into a border dispute with Russia, what, 10,000 miles east of here? Seven? I don't actually know how many. What's the diameter of the Earth, or the circumference of the Earth anyway? How far is it to halfway around? Anybody in the chat room know? I guess I could Google it. Man, it's really far from home to be having a border dispute with somebody. It's their border, not ours. That's kind of the end of the argument. Apparently, the people of America agree with me on that one, by the way. Only a quarter of Americans see Russia as an enemy. It says here in The Atlantic, the crisis in Ukraine has changed public opinion, but not radically. And, of course, it's the coverage of the Ukrainian crisis that's changed opinion at all. Anyway, so Ray McGovern, back when he was a CIA analyst, he was a Soviet specialist. And so he knows a thing or two about the background here, and he's talked about it on the show in the past. If you missed it, go back and check the archives at scotthorton.org. There are two of them with Ray McGovern since this current crisis broke out there. And I don't know, I probably interviewed him about the Orange Revolution back in 04, too. I don't know. Possibly. End of 04, beginning of 05. Anyway, Ray, he sure knows his stuff, and he's going to be on the show to talk about it. And then also Adam Morrow, who hasn't written anything for IPS News in a while, but that's all right. I think I sort of have kind of a standard list of things I think I need to know about what's going on in Egypt. And he's been living there, doing his day job. And getting by. So, anyway, he sure knows what's going on. So we're going to have Adam back on the show. I've been talking with Adam since the dawn of the Arab Spring, at the beginning of 2011. And he's a great journalist and really knows his stuff. So he'll be on to talk all about that. Now, I don't want to go too far into Ukraine really today because that's going to be the Ray McGovern interview and all that. But I should let you know that the... there may be a crisis here. I don't really know. Barbara Starr at CNN, I don't put much stock in her. She actually has a pretty widely regarded reputation as a stenographer. That's the wrong way to say that. She is widely regarded as a stenographer for the Pentagon. She doesn't know nothing but how to take notes and repeat what they say. And she's wrong about a lot of stuff a lot of time because what they tell her to say is wrong. A lot of the time. But she's saying that they're telling her at the Pentagon, and then supposedly CIA or some kind of intelligence says so too. Oh, classified intelligence assessment she has not seen but has had described to her by anonymous officials. Say that there's a buildup. Now, this report says 30,000, more than 30,000 Russian forces on the border with Ukraine. And then I saw other numbers that said 40,000, and then I was just talking with Eric Garris from Antiwar.com, and he said now they're saying, and I don't know if he meant they being CNN or exactly who, but some reports are that 100,000 Russian soldiers are massing on the eastern border. Well, their western border, Ukraine's eastern border, and could possibly invade there. And I don't know. I look at this two ways. Well, maybe more that I haven't thought of yet. But the first way I look at it is, you know, Putin might just do it. To say, yeah, that's what I thought. And what are you going to do about it? Yeah, that's what I thought. Because, hey, why not? He's out ahead. But then on the other hand, he seems like a pretty rational and pragmatic and not very emotional sort of an actor. And he's done real well so far in getting the Crimean Peninsula. And he's going to be in power one way or the other for many years to come. And he has plenty of time to take back the rest of Ukraine if that's what he really thinks he wants to do. Or even just the East. And it might make him look pretty bad in the eyes of, you know, leaders of other countries other than America. And it might have consequences for Russia that he calculates are too high. But I don't know. I thought, you know, here's the unreality of the situation up there. This is the bubble. And it is an inflationary bubble in a way. This is the cocoon, the bubble of nonsense that the people in power in the West, really, I guess, is certainly in America, live in. Gareth was talking about Obama bringing up the Israeli-forged alleged studies documents and demanding the Iranians account for them in their negotiations on the peace, on the nuclear deal that Obama wants. But then he's bringing up forgeries and saying, disprove them. Account for this. And, you know, because he lives in this bubble where he believes his own propaganda. He probably doesn't even really know that they're Israeli forgeries. He thinks that this is something that should be part of the negotiation. I don't know. He's sabotaging his own stupid thing. Well, here's an example of the bubble I saw today. Obama's given a press conference in Italy. He met the Pope, and he's hanging out with the Prime Minister or the President or whoever he is there, local politician guy. And so the reporter, and I don't think it was a Fox News reporter. I don't know, man. Not very good. I'm pretty good at remembering who's who in the newspapers, and the big newspapers, who writes what for them. But when it comes to the TV news anchors, I'm not as familiar with them. Their reporters. So whoever this guy was, he was an American reporter. And his question to Obama, it's not word for word, but basically was, isn't it the case that you're taking a military option off the table amounts to an invitation? I'm fairly certain that was, you know, one of his exact words. Amounts to an invitation to Putin to go ahead and invade as much of Ukraine as he wants. And, like, he asked 10 other questions, so Obama got to that one last. I don't know if I even stayed tuned that long for his answer. But this just goes to show the unreality, the bubble that not just the politicians, but the media people live in. And what is this guy talking about? What is he, a little kid or something? What military option? He can ask this question of the President of the United States, but his own brain is not required of him that he answer the question himself, to himself. Well, what military options actually does America have for keeping Russia out of eastern Ukraine? Nuclear war. That's what we've got. That's what the military option against Russia means. It means a thermonuclear exchange over eastern Ukraine? That's your question? Wasn't it irresponsible for the president to take nuclear war off the table for preventing Russia from invading eastern Ukraine? And the guy wasn't asking it like a devil's advocate because, you know, I heard some numbnut say this on Fox News. This was really his question. How irresponsible was it of you, Mr. President, to announce beforehand that nuclear war is not an option here? Because that's what military option means when it comes to a confrontation with Russia. Or you think what? That we just have a conventional war with Russia. And then, you know, I don't know, it'll probably work out. Right? Yeah, well, I got the same imagination as Bill Kristol. It goes about 45 minutes ahead of whatever's going on. Yeah, see, what we'll do is we'll have a conventional war with Russia, and then what? What does that mean? I've never heard the phrase, then what? Quite irresponsible, Mr. President, to take the military thermonuclear warfare option, the extinction of mankind, off the table in this crisis. Don't you think? Wouldn't you admit? Wouldn't you take it back if you could? Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. My friend Arlo just sent me this picture of the Berlin Wall. He says, I think only the skaters noticed that the Berlin Wall had coping. Hey, it does. Single coping spine. Very funnest thing in the whole wide world. Pretty tight transitions, but, you know, you can work it out. All right, so, that same reporter that asked Obama about how irresponsible it obviously was for him to take the military option off the table for keeping Russia out of Ukraine said, shouldn't we be moving right now to move international peacekeepers into Ukraine? Why are you hesitating to lay down tripwires for the extinction of humanity, Mr. President? God dang, you're just gonna let this Putin walk all over you. You big bitch, said the reporter to the President of the United States. It was hilarious. And Obama's like, let's talk about your other questions. The guy asked him like 10 questions. What about the Hobby Lobby case? Or, you know, I don't know what it was. Completely unrelated things. But that apparently is that a big idea? I haven't done a tour of all the, you know, neocon think tank websites. I really should do that. Spend more time reading over at AEI. It's kind of hard to take sometimes, but anyway, that's going on. And and I got to talk about this because I don't know if I'll have time to bring this up. Wow, this will come up during Ray's interview, but let me just bring this up. The headline is at antiwar.com right now. The headline reads, Paramilitary Right Fills Ukraine Power Vacuum. All right, but the actual headline is, Swedes Patrol Ukraine Streets with Right-Wing Paramilitaries. And it's about how the right sector guys are now the police force in Kiev. The police force is gone. Partially because the previous government had sort of purged the police force and had their own special police, and they've been obliterated and disbanded and spread to the winds. And so all that's left is the low-level police, and they've been intimidated, and they're now the lower ranks. And the neo-Nazis have taken control of the streets of Kiev, and they've got neo-Nazis from all around Europe coming in to help out. And what they are, they're hardcore right wing. They call themselves ethnic nationalists. Which means they've got a lot of blood to spill because look at how messy all the population groupings are throughout Europe. Far from perfect. And this is the group that the Americans have put in power. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible to me. And it's the neoconservatives who have done this. Who have done this for, I don't know why. because they still hate Russia because they're Trotskyites and they can't get over their grudge against the Stalinists who've been out of power for 25 years? Is that it? Or is it because, as Robert Perry assumes over at Consortium News, that they're just trying to screw up the Iran nuclear deal any way they can? And if they can, you know, start a whole new Cold War, if they need to start a whole new Cold War with Russia in order to drive a wedge between us and them on the P5 plus one talks, they'll do that. They'd do anything. So there's that. And then also, of course, the neoconservative movement, as Andrew Coburn puts it, is really, more than anything, he says, this is the alliance between the Israel lobby, I guess, more or less the right wing of it, and the military-industrial complex. Because, of course, the oil men and the bankers, they already have the Council on Foreign Relations and basically generations worth of intellectuals churning out crap justifying all their imperialism and all of that. But then the new kind of industrial, military-industrial complex wealth that grew up after World War II and then, you know, all, of course, through Vietnam and whatever, those guys, they didn't really have their own think tanks and their own kind of rationalizations. They were basically, they were cashing in, of course, on the policies of the old establishment, but they weren't really the people setting the policy. And so what they wanted to do was set the policy. And so they hooked up with Richard Perle and them. And this is, you know, I keep trying to tell y'all to read Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels by Richard Cummings. And that's what it's all about. It's, I don't even know if they still have it at Playboy.com. Maybe they do. It's at corpwatch.org, that's for sure. And in fact, I think I may have even copied and pasted that on my own website if I was thoughtful enough to remember to do so. It might be there under the fair use page at scotthorton.org. But that's what it's about. It's about how you go back and you look at the neoconservative network in the Bush government that got us into war with Iraq. And I mean, you know, the ones that Colin Powell hated and called the separate government, the Feith's Gestapo office and all of this stuff, right? Old guard being pushed out and resenting the new guys coming in. And Richard Cummings said that, yeah, well, these guys were all working for Lockheed. In fact, the only one of them that didn't work for Lockheed was Hadley. Stephen Hadley, the deputy national security advisor in the first Bush administration, became the national security advisor in the second Bush Jr. administration. He was a lawyer for the law firm that represented Lockheed. The rest of them actually had done at least one thing or another for Lockheed. Or were sitting on the board of it. And I mean Perle and Wolfowitz and I think Feith and Libby and Wurmser and probably Bolton too and a whole bunch of the, I don't know. I haven't read the article in forever. But it was about how, that was the way I remember it anyway. That virtually anyone that you could say, Shulsky, any of these guys that you would identify as the actual neocon fifth column inside the Bush Jr. government in the first 4 years of it there, especially, that those guys, they were all Lockheed guys. They were Lockheed guys before they were Ariel Sharon's guys. And sure as hell before they were Exxon's guys. Their job was selling planes. Cashing in on tax wealth. And anyway. That's what he says in that same thing. That's what NATO expansion was all about in the first place. It was Bruce Jackson from Lockheed. Oh, he truly believed, he swears, it was his sincere belief that we better expand NATO and completely surround and provoke Russia. Because he could sell more planes that way. That's why he believed it. This is his job to believe it. Oh, yeah, no, American national interest and this, that, and the other thing. Yeah, and jet airplane sales. And anyway, you know, I'm kind of ashamed because somebody took my rant about the George Kennan, the piece that Thomas Friedman wrote about George Kennan back in 1998 about his opposition to NATO expansion, and I'm going off in the damn thing, and it's too bad that I sound like such a damn clown in it, because otherwise it's really good. But it's worth bringing up again. It's just so important. Here's George Kennan, the guy who was the you know, the chairman of the foreign policy establishment, basically. He was X. He was the original State Department weenie that wrote for the Council on Foreign Relations journal, Foreign Affairs, that we must contain the Soviet Union. That's the policy. He invented the Cold War of containing them. And then, as I have to mention every time, John Mueller in the book Overblown explains how that helped prop up the Soviet Union. I don't think probably deliberately, but in effect, it helped prop up the Soviet Union for a long time, and it was when America quit containing them and allowed them to take on further obligations that they finally drove themselves completely to bankruptcy. You might recognize the same pattern happening to our empire right here. Nobody left to contain us. But anyway, George Kennan, he was, you know, a higher rank than Kissinger and Brzezinski, at least as far as respectability, right? He was like senior to them. He might as well have been, you know, Dean Acheson still alive, or Averell Harriman still alive, or something. He was the foreign policy guru of all. And he said, when the Russian reaction to NATO expansion comes, the people responsible for the expansion will cite that as the excuse and say that it justifies and it proves their case about Russian intentions, but it's just not so. They are the ones who are starting it. Mark my words. He's basically, I don't know, he doesn't say exactly mark my words, but mark his words. There he is in 1998. And he's saying, I'm George Kennan. I'm back in your history now, 1998, telling you, you shouldn't have done this. There's going to be consequences. And when the consequences come, you're going to pretend that the consequences are the reason. But we should all know better now. And so there it is. I mean, you just can't argue with that. It's perfect. And go back and read it. It's just search X or George Kennan, Thomas Friedman, NATO expansion, any of those key terms together in your favorite search engine. And it's on this side of the paywall for you because it's old archives at the New York Times, so they'll let you have it. And you can read what he says there, and it's just as obvious as it could be. And, you know, I really should get this book and read about this at length, because Robert Perry cites this. It's Robert Gates's new book, George Bush and Barack Obama's Secretary of Defense. Bush's last one, Obama's first one. But he lasted for years. Obama kept him for years, right? He's the guy that did the surge in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's George Bush Sr.'s man, who was sent to replace Rumsfeld, but to implement, which is interesting, right? But to implement the neocon policy of doubling down on the surge at the time that James Baker was recommending going ahead and getting out. But anyway, but Gates, and he was the former very political lying head of the CIA, deputy director of the CIA under William Casey in the Ronald Reagan years, etc. And anyway, in his new book, he says that back at the end of the Cold War, in 1989 through 1991, that where Baker and them wanted to actually prop up the Soviet Union, Cheney was worse. Cheney wanted to dismember even Russia into as many pieces as possible. And I think there's a real reason to believe that regime change there is still the American policy, even if they don't write it in the national security strategy. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., natsummit.org. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And, look here. Lick? Well, if you want. Look here. Nick Terse has written a thing. scratch the needle off the record. Extra, extra, Nick Terse wrote something. Stop what you're doing and listen up. It's really important. It's called America's Nonstop Ops in Africa. U.S. military averaging more than a mission a day in Africa. Documents reveal blinding pace of ops in 2013. More coming in 2014. Oh, man. You know, I don't know what this dude is doing when he's not writing about Africa, but boy, is Nick Terse hard to get a hold of. Jesus. And the thing is, he's such a great journalist. And I know he means well. I get emails from him back every once in a while saying, yeah, sorry that didn't work out. But boy, is he hard to reach, man. I don't know. But man, he turns out great journalism. You know, it'd be fun to sit down and read, I don't know, 10 things that Nick Terse wrote about American Africa. I bet you'd have a real good picture of what the hell right then. And have more than enough reason to be concerned. I mean, seriously, man. You know, they announced the other day about going to look for Joseph Kony again in Uganda. Really? By the way, man, I saw the funniest South Park where I guess at the end Stan ends up jacking it in San Diego. Man, that's the funniest thing in the world, dude. I love South Park so much. Anyway, sorry for the digression, but it was important for me to say that, I think. So listen. I don't know nothing about what America's doing in Africa compared to what they're actually doing in Africa. But here's what I do know. I know the Americans have gotten 250,000 Somalis killed, most of them by starvation. A lot of them blown up to death, too. But hundreds of thousands of them, of course, mostly children and elderly. They're the first ones to succumb, starved to death. And there was a famine in Eastern Africa, in the Horn of Africa region there, in Eritrea and in Ethiopia too, and down into Kenya, I guess too, for about 2 years there. But it was the American war in Somalia that caused hundreds of thousands of people. Hey, really, man? Hundreds of thousands of people starved to death. Like in the worst days of Michael Jackson and Cyndi Lauper and Hands Across America to save the poor, starving, dying Ethiopians. Remember that? Oh, maybe don't. That was when I was a kid. And anyway, but it was America that did it to him. Simple as that. I saw where somebody had posted my article on Twitter and someone responded to that with just a LOL. As though, self-evidently couldn't possibly be true that America bears any responsibility for starving all these people to death. But the fact is, the reason their crops didn't get sown, mostly, and the reason that the crops that did get sown didn't get harvested and didn't get to market was because of the war. And of course, sorry, I should have continued. What did get harvested didn't get to market because there was no market. It got blown up and nobody had any money to buy anything at it. And then, damn it, I was just reading this thing the other day that it had flaws, so I didn't run it at antiwar.com. Oh, you know what? It was Patrick Coburn, but it was just too off point, if you could believe that. Had too much of the good that USA did for my taste. But he had quotes from the Somalis talking about, oh yeah, and then the wonderful NGOs come with all their food. But they don't buy the food from any Somalis who actually are able to get some crops sown and harvested and transported anywhere. No, they bring their own. They take American surplus wheat and prop up American prices and dump it on the Somali market and bankrupt the actual Somali farmers who have the ability to grow anything. Yeah, thanks a lot for the help. God, man. Sometimes I wish I was Jesus so I could just damn people straight to hell for the horrible things that they do. How dare you do-gooders with your nonsense. Oh, yeah, we're going to go help the Somalis. Yeah, the U.S. government, they gave us C-130 full of wheat, man. I can't think of why they had any other vested interest in doing so. Propping up prices for their political cronies back home, whatever. And I don't know nothing about what a market is or what supply and demand means. And I don't even have to care about whether what I'm doing is going to bankrupt the few local farmers who are able to get the job done with the slightest margin of profit. Because I'm going to go home and go to grad school and be a hippie for a while after this and blah, blah, blah. And who cares about consequences, right? We're doing good for our NGO. Saving the Somalis that our government starved to death and then sent here to continue to starve to death by destroying what little of their market actually functions. We're so proud. Everybody gather around, take a selfie. We're doing good for the little people there. And then on to Libya, where Obama fought a war for the Mujahideen, for the veterans of the Iraq War, the guys who fought for Zarqawi. The guys who fought for the Islamic State of Iraq. You know, the suicide bomber terrorists who are at war in Iraq and Syria right now. Yeah, well, a lot of those guys, when they fought back in the worst days of Bush Jr.'s war in Iraq, a lot of them were Libyans. A lot of them came from a lot of other places, too, and have gone home to those places, including Libya, where, guess where they lived? In Benghazi, where Obama pretended... The most obvious, obvious, ridiculous, stupid lie in the whole world. I don't even know if anybody bothered to buy it. That Gaddafi is going to murder every last man, woman, and child in Benghazi, a city the size of Charlotte, if we don't stop him. Because, you know, that's what America cares about. Innocent people getting killed. And so we have to intervene. And so they intervened in Libya and they brought to power these guys who are, they're half Bin Laden, they're half Ku Klux Klan. The first thing they did was commit serious, horribly violent, like Mississippi burning type pogroms against blacks. Because the rumor was that, hey, if you're black, you know, a sub-Saharan African up in Libya, well, then, oh, you're here because you're a mercenary working for Gaddafi and his army that's kept us down all this time, his Gestapo. And so, all of you are mercenaries. Doesn't matter if, obviously, you're the lowest-level carpenter, right? Doesn't matter if you're a kid or some woman, but no, you're all the mercenaries of Gaddafi. And so, and then blam, David Anders, our friend David Anders from McClatchy. That guy, I hope he's got a good psychiatrist, man, to help him deal with all of the horrible things that he's seen and reported on in the last 10 years at least. Maybe longer than that, including the worst parts of the Iraq War, for example. But David Anders, man, he was there interviewing black women in the refugee camps after the war, talking about the Mujahideen coming in and committing mass rapes every night. Every night. Not like in the propaganda, the make-believe lies of Susan Rice, who pretended. Did anybody bother to buy this? That Gaddafi was passing out Viagra to his army, that they might stop their combat and rape every woman they find on the roads between Tripoli and Benghazi. Oh, really, huh? I remember, too. It's so funny about confirmation bias and all that. I remember I was living in L.A. at the time, driving down Sunset Boulevard, listening to the local right-wing Rush Limbaugh clone on the radio saying, even Susan Rice says that there's a mass rape program going on there. And since she's supposedly the exact opposite of me, that proves that I'm right, that it must be true. This horrible war criminal Gaddafi must be stopped. Like, this guy knew anything about it or cared one way or the other. He's just making his money being a Rush Limbaugh clone. Being a conservative, it's pretty easy. You just have to be for killing everyone and everything all the time. You have to hate anything that's true. And deny anything that's true, and you can be a conservative. So, anyway, that was where they found some common ground there. And what they did to Libya was they turned it over to warring tribal militias that have destroyed the place. And I don't know if anybody's even keeping count of who's dying of easily treatable diseases in other circumstances right now, who's starving to death there right now, as their entire society's breaking down. Not that Gaddafi was some benevolent tyrant, but it was certainly not America's job to regime change him, and especially fighting directly for these guys. And, you know, Patrick Coburn, he was there at the time. I think I interviewed him from Libya. Didn't I? Or maybe when he just got back and he's going, no, I think I even interviewed him while he was there in 2011. And Patrick Coburn was saying, dude, there's more media than Mujahideen at the front. I mean, this is America's war. They're letting the special forces, the European and American special forces and spies and the Air Force do all the work. And that was why, they didn't have much of a militia to speak of, really. Not as an effective ground fighting force. They could be terrorists, but not really a fighting force. And it took, Obama pretended the other day in his speech that all it took was some kind of nudge or something. He skipped the part where America fought the whole war there. He said, we didn't cause the protest movement in Libya. Yeah, but it took you 9 months to bomb that regime out of power. What does that say? That tyranny had some support, maybe if only because some of the tribes preferred the Gaddafi tyranny to what was coming. And, you know, go and read the Black Agenda report by Glenn Ford. That's one of the only news outlets in the world that I can even tell you about. And I've tried to find on this. I'm not the world's best on it or whatever, but the Black Agenda report, they're some of the only people who have covered this at all. In fact, I have a book that they talk about at their site. About America's war in Libya that I mean to get to as soon as I can for you. But they've done great work on the pogroms there. And, you know, RT, Russian RT, showed where blacks were being rounded up and being held in the zoo and being humiliated and taunted and forced, gagged with Libyan flags and all this stuff. Go look it up. That's American Africa for you. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org. Nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. offnow.org. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR silver commodity discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, Adam Morrow and Ray McGovern. They got real expertise, you know. I'm just doing my best cribbing off of what I learned from people like them. I think I do all right. But yeah, so the occupation of Africa has continued on. Go read Nick Terse. Read his book, Kill Anything That Moves, about Vietnam, too. That thing will blow you away, man. Figuratively speaking. But yeah, there he is at tomdispatch.com. Nick Terse, America's Nonstop Ops in Africa. And so now listen, I talked about this a little bit yesterday, but I guess I sort of want to try to do a little bit better about it. What Obama said about Iraq, comparing Iraq to Crimea and saying Crimea is worse. A million people killed, or at least very high hundreds of thousands of Iraqis killed, and consequences that will last through the generations. For real. It's the first time Shia have controlled an Arab capital city in 1,000 years. Now, you don't have to know anything about it to know that that sounds like it might be a big deal. Yeah, it is. And the whole place is bankrupt. The whole place is corrupt. And there's just no legitimacy to any of these regimes. They're all coming down, and they're all going to war. The Israelis are still lording it over everybody with their nukes. Boy, if there was one you shouldn't have done that anybody should have never done, man, it was this. In fact, I don't know if this is true, but for some reason I believe it, that it's Max Blumenthal's father, Sidney Blumenthal, who used to work for Bill Clinton and wrote a lot of great stuff about internal fights inside the Republican Party for Salon.com in the Bush Jr. years. And in fact, I think Max said on the show that he wrote a whole book about it, compiled all that stuff into a whole book. And it's all about, like I was talking about earlier with Sheldon Richmond, about the splits between the neocons and the, well, off the air, me and him were talking about the splits between the neocons and the oil men on Iraq and all that kind of thing. But in there, I think it's an unidentified source claims that when Bush gave his 48-hour speech, when he said, Saddam, you better leave town, but either way, even if you do or if you don't, we're invading anyway, in 48 hours speech, that James Baker turned to his friend on the couch watching on TV and said, oh, I told him not to do that. And, well, there you go. Man, we all tried, didn't we? There are millions of Americans, literally millions of Americans, who turned out to protest and say no to that war. Tried to stop them, but man, those consequences are just going to keep coming through. What, 1,000-something people killed there in January, hundreds and hundreds in February, hundreds so far now in March. Sorry, I'm so far off on this tangent. One person, maybe. There was a rumor, there was a headline that claimed one person was shot, one Ukrainian soldier was shot, but I don't even think that's true. I hadn't heard any more about it. Apparently, the Russians took the Crimean Peninsula with the assent of the people of Crimea. Even Henry Kissinger wrote a thing in the Washington Post saying, man, Russia was born in Kiev. You guys don't know anything about it. Maybe you should just slow down a little bit. These two nations have been intertwined since before there was such a thing as a Westphalian nation state in Europe of any kind. You know, these two kingdoms, or whatever the hell they are, czarist provinces. Catherine the Great annexed Crimea officially for the first time in the 1780s, at the time of the formation of the Articles of Confederation. When, you know, George Washington still roamed the earth, is when Catherine the Great annexed Crimea. And then I was just reading, there's an article running at antiwar.com, I guess, maybe today or tomorrow or something, but anyway, about where he talks about why Khrushchev gave it to Ukraine. It was all the Soviet Union at the time, and Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine by his edict because it was part of some planned hydroelectric experiment, or not experiment, but project that they were working on, that for whatever bureaucratic reasons, he decided to be better handled if the Ukrainians and you know, had the authority over the Crimeans on the issue to help iron out the differences and whatever and make the thing go. And then he quotes John Bolton, and man, I really should go back and double check this, but he quotes John Bolton at a previous time before the crisis, get this, what would now be an admission, it's just Bolton showing you how smart he is and how much he knows, I guess, at the time, the way he brought it up in the context at the time when he brought it up, that one of the other reasons that Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine was he was trying to dilute the remaining pro-Nazi sentiment in Western Ukraine by adding more Russians. And in fact, Rand Paul said he thought this was a good reason why Putin should not annex it back before he annexed it was, well, he didn't say it exactly that way about the Nazis, but he said the Russians will be taking however million, I forgot, was it 1 million or something almost, you know, Russian-leaning people out of the Ukrainian political system, which would be giving the advantage to the West, right? Well, that's the opposite effect is what Khrushchev was going for then. And the way Bolton put it was there were too many people in Western Ukraine who were still pro-Hitler. The Banderists. You know, the people America just put in power there. People who rule the streets of Kiev today, right now. In fact, here they are. Is this thing? Oh, I got to hit refresh on this thing. I'm watching on Ustream. The brown shirts, the right sector movement, are holding a giant protest in Kiev right now. I think Ustream is going to play a couple commercials first. They're holding a giant rally right now, insisting that one minister or another be forced out. They're far from not a big deal in this thing. And, you know, yeah, anyway, well, here they are. Here's some audio. That's them banging on the door of a government building. The giant mob, these guys all got black ski masks on. They got the black and red flags of their neo-Nazi movement. It's a massive right sector protest going on right now. It's, in fact, it's a pretty easy URL if you're at a URL typing machine. You all have one in your pocket if you want to look at it. It's U, the letter U, stream.tv. Not U like YouTube, but the letter U, stream.tv/channel/QTPOV13. So, POV obviously point of view, so you remember that, right? QT is spelled with a K. So it's the letter U, stream.tv/channel/QTPOV13. That's probably more URL reading than I should do on the show. But anyway, if you want to look at it, that's it. I tweeted it. I retweeted it. If you want to look at my Twitter, at Scott Horton Show, you can find the link there as well. Sorry, I can't translate for you what they're yelling about. But these are the brown shirts that America just put in power in the highest levels. Not the very highest, but still the highest levels of the new Ukrainian government in Kiev. Oh, but I heard that history began the other day when Putin annexed Ukraine. You mean history began back a few days before that when the Americans put Nazis in power in Kiev? I wonder if that might could have provoked the Russian annexation of Crimea. Oh, no, that's just propaganda, Scott, that Nazis are involved in this. Really? I'm looking at a giant rally of Nazis right now. According to, Maiden PR official Twitter, this is a right sector rally, and there they are with all their symbols and what have you. Come on, guys, show me some 88s and some lightning bolts. What Nazis? Oh, they're now the police of the capital city? Oh, those guys. Yeah, it's not like they have any authority or anything. Nothing for you to concern yourself with. And yes, Vladimir Putin should shoot himself in the head for being such a horrible guy. I told you before 100 times that, or I don't know how many times, but it's true that, well, according to my wife, who's an investigative reporter, whose word I take for it, and according to Eric Margulies, who used to be an investigative reporter and is now somewhat an investigative reporter, but more of a columnist, but still obviously knows everything. He says so too. That's my two sources, and they're pretty damn good. And they both say that Vladimir Putin killed their friend Anna Politkovskaya, the Skivskaya lady, whose name I can't say. And she was the reporter who was investigating on the Beslan massacre. And what all aspects of it, I'm not certain. I think possibly that Putin was behind it or something. But anyway, I don't know the details of that, but the wife says that Putin murdered her. And that was the wife's friend. So I take that real personal. This guy, this politician that TV is telling you to hiss and spit at, he actually killed my wife's friend. Murdered her to death. Not just he killed some people, but he killed my wife's friend. So, I hate him. I hate him as much as you need me to hate him. I hate him before you hate him. I hate him before you and more. I hate him even for existing at all and being a former KGB officer and for being a politician at all. But this is still all America's fault, not Russia's, obviously. Don't be an idiot. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Ooh, this just in, breaking. Satellite pictures of possible wreckage in the ocean. We interrupt anything important in the world to bring you the latest news. The plane is somewhere at the bottom of the sea. Now weather. It's raining in the bottom of the sea where the plane is somewhere. Gotta love CNN. Amazing. All right. Adam Morrow is up. He's a reporter for Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net, and he writes from Cairo, Egypt, when he does write. But anyway, how are you doing, Adam? Are you there?
I'm doing all right. Oh, how are you, Scott? How are you doing?
I'm doing real good. I appreciate you joining us today. Sorry for the not very funny joke there at the beginning. Don't worry. We'll cut that out of the archive.
No worries. Is there a media frenzy about the jet? Is that the idea?
You know, it's
sort of like
so
a Chilean
ridiculous
situation. If you remember that a couple years ago,
it's so ridiculous. It's like we're in a TV show, and this is what's on the news in a TV show. Real life could never be this completely stupid and absurd. You know what I mean? But no, that's
right.
All they've been talking about for three weeks is. There's a plane somewhere at the bottom of the ocean.
There was a similar weird frenzy with the Chilean miners 2 or 3 years ago, if you remember that.
There
was this bizarre media obsession that lasted for several weeks as they were extracted one by one painstakingly, and the media covered every last detail.
Yeah, anything but housing demolitions in East Jerusalem, right?
Right, exactly,
All right, so give us the latest on Field Marshal Sisi.
Well, let's see. Last night, in a televised address to the nation, he announced his candidacy for president, which actually doesn't really come as a surprise to anybody. I mean, I think we spoke in our last conversation that there's been a long, drawn-out sort of will he, won't he sort of thing going on for the last several months, ever since the coup, which was almost 9 months ago now. He's been sort of doing this dance about, you know, sort of these dropping these hints that he would run and sort of denying it and then, you know, speaking to a foreign newspaper and mentioning that he was going to, you know, mentioning that he was about to announce his candidacy, and then an official spokesman would come out later and deny that. And I think a lot of it was gauging of public opinion. I think a lot of it was the test balloons that they were sending up just to see how the public would react to these kind of announcements. And now, finally, we have it officially. Late last night, he appeared on television wearing military fatigues and basically announced that he had resigned from the from his position as defense minister to become a civilian, and has now, you know, he's no longer Egypt's army chief and is now ready to contest the elections as a civilian. So, but again, it really doesn't come as that much of a surprise.
All right. And so now, when are the elections going to be held, the ones that he's going to be running in? They're having presidential elections first and then parliament later, maybe. Is that right?
So supposedly, well, I mean, one of the things that makes this whole experience such a farce, this whole so-called electoral process such a farce, is the fact that the whole process has been sort of waiting for him, You know what I'm saying? From what I understand, in the next couple of days, an official announcement is going to be made, and they're going to announce the dates of presidential of the presidential elections. But just what's interesting is that like the whole, everything was put on hold until it was sort of decided whether or not he was going to run. And now that he has, apparently, like they can now set the dates for elections. I mean, the whole thing is basically dependent on one guy, and it also looks like he's only going to have one real competitor, which is the leftist candidate from the last election. I think he came in third in the 2012 polls after Mohamed Morsi and Ahmed Shafiq, if you remember that. And that's Hamdi Sabahi, who's the leftist candidate. Looks like he's going to be the only real contender, other contender for the post as it stands now.
Mm-hmm. And
so we'll see. We might have the emergence of some other candidates in the weeks ahead. It sort of depends when elections are going to be. You know, it depends on when the election dates are. You know, whether it's going to be 1 month from now or whether it's going to be 3 months from now. We might have a bunch. There were a total of 13 candidates in the 2012 poll. We might see the emergence of
The guy that you
Sorry?
Just mentioned. What's his name again?
Hamdi Sabahi.
Uh-huh. And who does he represent exactly?
He's sort of the leftist candidate. He was the main. If you remember, there were four or five big contenders in 2012 polls, and he was one of them. He's sort of like the big leftist representative. He's been a shameless supporter of the coup ever since it happened. He was balls to the walls against Morsi when Morsi was in office. Totally supported the coup jumped on board with both feet. He doesn't really represent, you know, real opposition to Sisi. I mean, he's more or less on the same page with Sisi, although, you know, he comes from a civilian background, and he comes from a supposedly leftist background. Mm. But as it stands now, those two look like they're going to be the two main competitors.
Well, and it sounds like, if anything, he at least might as well be working for Sisi and just, you know, trying to block anybody else.
Exactly. Well, what I'm thinking is what they might do is, nobody's really taking the election seriously in terms of integrity. It's interesting to note that about a week or two ago, Ahmed Shafiq, who came in second, who was a very close runner-up in the 2012 polls, basically a leak came out, a leaked conversation came out in which he said explicitly that the whole thing was a farce, and that that elections would be rigged in Sisi's favor. And he actually came out and took credit for having said it. He didn't deny having said it. He said he admitted to having said it. That's incredible. If you remember, Ahmed Shafiq was Hosni Mubarak's last prime minister, and he came in a very, very close second behind Morsi in 2012. And he's basically been staying in Abu Dhabi ever since he lost the elections in 2012. He's been in Abu Dhabi, and he stayed there until now. And he came out explicitly saying, again, it was a leaked conversation. He didn't intend for it to come out, but he didn't deny it. And he actually said he took credit for having said it. And he said stated explicitly that the elections would be rigged in Sisi's favor. So the whole thing is looking very iffy. And then again, at the same time, they might decide to throw it to Hamdi Sabahi. And then they can turn around and say, look, the Egyptians have chosen a civilian leadership. When all along they're both serving the same master at the end of the day. You know, Sabahi's a candidate who will never threaten the deep state the way Morsi threatened the deep state, the way Morsi and a Muslim Brotherhood-led government truly threatened Egypt's deep state. Yeah. These guys, I mean, the only people who are basically would be allowed to run are safe candidates. Candidates would be willing to run the show, but without actually, you know, taking on the entrenched deep corruption that characterizes the Mubarak deep state until now.
Yeah, I wouldn't bet on them throwing it to anybody to try to show anything. Sisi's got the power in his hands right now. The only reason he's resigned and decided to run is because he knows he's got it set his way, and he wants to be president, and he will be. Mm-hmm. The only one who can stop him now might be Obama.
I think he got it into
but
it.
Obama is probably the guy who arranged this whole thing in the first place, right?
Well, what's kind of interesting, though, about this, and it's something I've noticed, this is a trend that I've sort of noticed, is I think his popularity is definitely on the wane. If you remember, there was a lot of talk about the Sisi mania, and, you know, people were wearing Sisi t-shirts, and everybody's, you know, waving his picture and putting pictures up in storefronts and all of this sort of thing. What's interesting is they tried to push some pro-Morsi demonstrations in the constitutional referendum that happened in the middle of February. And those went over. Those did not go over. I mean, they tried to mobilize people out on the streets, and the response was very, very weak. There were here and there. There were sort of sporadic demonstrations that were very heavily protected, and looked to consist mostly of people like public sector workers that they might have given £50 to go out and stand out there. And the same thing happened today and yesterday. Is one would have expected if this guy was riding this incredible wave of unparalleled popularity, one would have expected people to have hit the streets in celebration of his announcement, and that hasn't happened. That hasn't happened at all, with a few very, very minor exceptions here and there. People are calling for such rallies tomorrow. People are calling for Friday pro-CC rallies tomorrow to sort of celebrate his candidacy. So we'll see sort of tomorrow. Tomorrow will be an interesting litmus test to see if he can still draw the crowds. If you remember that he managed to pull a month after the coup, he called on the Egyptian people to come out and sort of, you know, come out in his support and give him a popular mandate to fight terrorism, if you remember that. And people did turn out. I mean, he did manage to pack Tahrir Square. I had to walk through it to get home from work. So I saw it with my own two eyes. He definitely, you know, but that was last summer.
Well, so and listen, I mean, from
the same kind of draw now.
At least from the images coming over TV, it was a reasonable facsimile of the Arab Spring uprising of January and February 2011, but it was not the same. I mean, you could tell the difference where you had left, right, and poor and working and middle class and everybody from any faction you could think of represented out there in 2011. And last summer, it was a lot of some of those factions. But it was clearly not the same. And I'm sorry, we're at the break here. We got to go do some commercials. We'll be right back with Adam Morrow from Interpress Service, ipsnews.net, right after this.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Adam Morrow from IPSNews.net. And he writes from Cairo, Egypt. And we're talking about America's sock puppet fascist dictatorship there and the pretension of some kind of election or peaceful exchange of power. And it's really the same thing as the Mubarak era. Yeah, he didn't wear a general's uniform. I always called him General Mubarak because that's what he was, as a military dictator with, what, a different costume? He was the head of the military. That's what he was, and that was what made him the head of the country, the same as this guy, Sisi. And so you know what I'm most interested to hear about from you now? Or actually, say whatever you want if you didn't get to finish up anything from the last segment there. Sorry, Adam. But also, I would have you address, if I could,
no,
the police
okay.
state and torture and
sure,
death
sure.
penalty, death sentences being handed down, and persecution of the electoral right, as you might call them.
Sure, sure. The only point I wanted to make about from what we were saying before is just that the comparison, I think it's worth, people need to sort of draw the contrast between what happened in January and February of 2011 and the June 30, 2013 anti-Morsi protest. In the former, you had people basically sitting in and occupying Tahrir Square for a period of 18 days and getting the crap kicked out of them frequently. You had 800 people die during those 18 days countrywide. And as compared to the anti-Morsi protests in 2013, the middle of 2013, which lasted basically one day, which were basically lots and lots of people like taking their kids, you know, taking their whole families down, right, sort of making a day of it, you know, cool picnic in Tahrir Square.
And it was so obvious when
absolutely suffering no kind of physical threat whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean,
so
CC...
I mean, people seem to need, because a lot of people like to compare the two and sort of say like, oh, we've had two Egypt has had two revolutions. I mean, the two were like entirely different animals. Yeah, and that's an important point.
It was a hoax. It was a hoax. CeCe went on TV and went, look, everybody, a massive protest. I have to prevent a civil war from breaking out. And then crickets. Everybody was like, what's civil war from breaking out? What are you talking about? It was so obvious that he was just using it as a prop. He might as well have said, hey, look, everybody, a bird in the sky. I have to take over the government now. You know? It's ridiculous.
Well, what's interesting about this charge, this accusation against Morsi that he was driving the country to civil war, and these claims that by CeCe that he was stepping in order to save the country from civil war. What's so interesting about that is that, and that brings us to the topic that you wanted to talk about, which is basically the crazy draconian stuff that's been going on here, the crazy death sentences that have been being thrown around recently. I mean, if anybody is risking a civil war, you know, if anybody is potentially driving the country to civil war, it's this guy, you know, it's this guy, it's this guy's policies, it's the stuff that this guy has done ever since taking over, ever since not only, you know, I was removing the elected president, a democratically elected president from office, but then imprisoning him, and everything that they've done since, where they've basically you know, it was. They were the ones who turned the whole conflict into an existential one. You know, before that, it was just a political conflict. They're the ones that accused the Brotherhood of being behind a bunch of terrorism without any sort of proof. You know, and they're the ones that started arresting them and torturing them. And more than one intelligent observer has said, like, it almost looks like they're trying to elicit a violent response. They want a violent response. Yeah. They're cracking down hard because they want a violent response so that they can then retaliate overwhelmingly. Mm-hmm. Take a page from the Israeli book and use that as an excuse. You know, elicit a reaction from your enemy so you have an excuse to annihilate them. And that's I think that's the strategy. And I mean, after handing out this mass death sentence of something like 550 plus Brotherhood guys, or not even Brotherhood guys. Apparently, most of them aren't even members of the Brotherhood. But 550 guys who were demonstrating against the coup or whatever, and hanging them, you know, and accusing them all of complicity in the death of a single police officer. I mean, this is just a drawn condemnation. It's drawn condemnation from all quarters. I mean, even a lot of the people who participated in the anti-Morsi stuff, even the solidly anti-Morsi elements here, you know, these so-called revolutionary leftist liberal elements, whatever, have all happened to condemn these death sentences because they're so ludicrous, because they're so, they happened after, I think, they were based on one or two court sessions. They had one court session, and then the following court session, within 5 minutes, they had decided to execute all these guys.
Yeah, I read somewhere
like 150 of whom are being tried in absentia.
Yeah, I read a thing where they got an average of 14 seconds worth of trial each, if you averaged it out between them. And so, well, you know, and Eric Margolis said, they'll cancel it. They won't, you know. If nothing else, I don't think he said this part, but I guess if nothing else, the Americans will call and say, dude, we can't have you hang 500 people at once like this or something like that. You can't do that, dude.
How could they be so stupid? It's like, didn't they learn their lesson? Didn't they learn their lesson with that ridiculous 11-year jail sentence on those teenage girls? If you remember, that was about 3 or 4 months ago. That was a huge international scandal where they basically sentenced a dozen teenage girls to 11 years each in prison because they had been participating in a pro-Morsi demonstration, and it caused international outrage, and in the end they canceled it. In the end they overturned it because it was so ridiculous, and they ended up losing on all fronts. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they ended up losing credibility. They ended up losing they didn't even, you know, the girls didn't even serve out the sentence. I mean, they didn't get anything from it. They didn't get any gain. They gained nothing from that except looking like a bunch of idiots and you know, discrediting themselves. Mm-hmm. And they seem to be doing the same thing again with this, with this massive death sentence that was delivered on Monday in Upper Egypt.
What about the Al Jazeera guys?
Another tranche of. Sorry?
I'm sorry. I'm terrible timing on this interview, Adam.
No, go ahead.
The long-distance delay. I was just going to ask you about the Al Jazeera journalists who've been arrested. I mean, they are, in effect, agents of the state of Qatar, right? Or not? Or how's that work?
Yeah, no, that's ridiculous. You're talking about the Jazeera journalists.
Right. I mean, it's sort of true that they work for the crown over there, right?
No. That they work for the crown, that they work for Qatar directly. I mean, first of all, you have to distinguish between their. Jazeera actually has multiple television channels, and they sort of all have slightly different. They seem to have slightly different agendas, and you have four of these journalists were working for Jazeera English, which definitely has a different political line than Jazeera Arabic, which is definitely pro brotherhood. Jazeera English has takes a more of an independent line. And four of those guys, including at least one or two foreign nationals, I believe, are still in jail. To be honest with you, I haven't been following it that closely. I know a couple of journalists have been released, although a number of them still remain in detention.
I'm not trying to support the jailing of any journalists, but I do think it's interesting that there seems to be kind of a proxy war, or there seems to have been a kind of a proxy war between Qatar and Saudi Arabia about who's going to take power in Egypt, right?
Well, this is another thing I don't think we've spoken since, I guess, 2 weeks ago or so when Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the UAE, I believe, all pulled their ambassador from Doha, from Qatar, which is amazing. I mean, because they're all members of the Gulf Cooperation Council, and they're a fairly tight-knit crowd. And the fact that three of them pulled their ambassadors from a fellow GCC member is pretty remarkable. I don't know if you noticed that. That was about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Mm. And they haven't returned yet.
Saved this thing.
The Egypt issue is actually causing big rifts within the Gulf itself, between the Gulf monarchies, which is just a very interesting point. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Nah, actually, I'm sorry, man. You go ahead, because what I was going to say ain't worth it.
Well, I mean, it's just interesting to point out the regional ramifications that this Egypt thing is. You know, people tend to just, you know, especially living here, everybody sort of tends to focus entirely on what's happening domestically because so much is happening and it's of such an intense nature right now. Mm-hmm. When in fact, this Egypt thing has, what's happening in Egypt is actually has had repercussions as far afield as places like Tunisia, which the ruling Islamist party there watched with great, with incredible dread and fear, what events in Egypt. I mean, if you remember, and then they actually weathered their own round of anti-government demonstrations. They managed to survive by cutting a deal with the opposition. So the Tunisian Islamists remain in place, more or less. But you've had it affect other countries in North Africa, like places like Tunisia. You've had it deeply affect the Gulf, where actually, like I said, three Gulf countries have pulled their ambassadors from a fellow Gulf country, being Qatar. And then you also have the Turkey connection. It's also very, very interesting because the Turks were very heavily invested in the Muslim Brotherhood here. They were very supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood here while they were in power. Right. And continue, I think Erdogan continues to sort of, you know, refer. He hasn't made a statement in a long time because he himself is now under incredible, you know, is now under this all this pressure.
Right.
But until recently, Erdogan was saying that Morsi was still Egypt's legitimate president. Which infuriated the authorities in Egypt. There's a strong, as well as an anti-American, you know, as well as this sort of anti-American thing going on here, there's also very strong anti-Turkish sentiments among the pro-army crowd, because they see Turkey as like Qatar as supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, which they do. And in fact, a lot of the Muslim Brotherhood guys who fled the country in fear of their lives are now in either Qatar or Turkey.
Mm. All right, now, I'm sorry, we have very little time left, but can you tell me if they've been successful at all in provoking the Muslim Brotherhood into fighting? Because we've heard about, you know, I've read like in Nancy Youssef about police are being assassinated all the time and there's some bombings here and there. And I'm wondering if that's the Muslim Brotherhood. I think she indicated, that's a McClatchy's reporter there, I think she indicated that it seems like the Muslim Brotherhood is restraining themselves and are under orders to not go for it. But there are some people who are taking up the opportunity to begin to try to wage an insurgency against the government there. Is that possible? And you got about 30 seconds to answer, you know, not even.
Sure. From what I understand, basically the Brotherhood is maintaining its policy of peaceful protest because it knows that if it does anything violent, that little tiny act, no matter how small, will be seized upon and exaggerated and inflated in the media. So they're doing everything they can to maintain their policy of peaceful protest. I talked way too much and wasted your interview.
Thanks, Adam. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you again soon. Adam Morrow, everybody. IPSnews.net.
My pleasure, Scott.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Next up is the great Ray McGovern. For 27 years, he was an analyst at the CIA, and he was the morning briefer for Vice President H.W. Bush in the 1980s, and he's the co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, which is asking a lot. Sorry, I've worn that one out. And let's see, he also speaks and writes. He writes at consortiumnews.com and at raymcgovern.com, and he's got a whole gigantic archive going back for years and years at antiwar.com and a lot of other places as well. And right now he's actually, I believe, in the middle of going around and doing a speaking tour promoting peace and freedom in one way or another over there. So welcome back to the show, Ray. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott. Yeah, I'm just promoting a little bit of truth. I'm trying to give truth a chance here, and I'm in Missouri, Kansas, and Arkansas, and really glad to be in the heartland here because it's quite different from being in the Beltway.
Yeah, good times. Well, I'm sure you're learning them well. So here, learn me some stuff. Let's talk about Ukraine. This Barbara Starr, here she is. She's on CNN International right now.
If a war to happen, would fundamentally change the calculus entirely.
Yeah, 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 calculus. God, I hate that calculus. I wish somebody would tell them to stop saying calculus. God, it's the worst thing in the world. But anyway, she's really saying is that Putin's getting ready to invade East Ukraine. Is that true, Ray? What do you think?
I don't think so, Scott. I flunked calculus, but nothing I know about Putin would suggest
optics too. That's the one I hate even more than calculus is optics. Just say how this looks, okay? Just how this looks is fine.
All right. Optics. Well, let me just cite one of my favorite columnists, who happens to be George Will. I make a joke, of course. But today in the Washington,
we know what that F stands for.
Well, I'm not going to say that. But George Will today in the Washington Post, which of course is the neoconservative Pravda, says something really interesting. What he says is this. He says, had it right in front of me here. Let me see if I can retrieve it. Well, what he says is, Putin says that he doesn't need to go into eastern Ukraine. And, that's really suspicious because that shows that he arrogates to himself the right to go into eastern Ukraine, and you better watch out. Now, what Putin said happens to be the fact. He doesn't need to go into eastern Ukraine, and as he watches $17 billion going into the western Ukraine, so much the better. Let them have all the money they want from the West. Ukraine is not going to be going into NATO anytime soon. As a matter of fact, if sensible people come to their senses, Ukraine will find a status very much like Finland, where they can prosper. They have all manner of natural resources there. The black earth. That's why Monsanto is very much interested in getting in there. In any case, there is a solution here. But it requires adult people to sit around a table, and it'll probably be another few weeks, if not months, before Obama is able to get to the adults around and say, okay, we're not going to dislodge Putin from the Crimea, which apparently he said today. Now let's see what we can do. I'm not so worried about the Russian troops. I am worried about you. You know what I'm going to say here, Islamic terrorists. And so Obama is already sort of trying to distance himself from the more crazy people.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that's good. And I guess, John Kerry. Well, how significant is this that John Kerry had agreed with Lavrov that, yeah, maybe we do need to rewrite the Ukrainian constitution to have some more federalism and some less centralism and that kind of thing? Is that, are they really going to do that, or is just that rhetorically means uncle, you know?
Well, you know, I shouldn't have to point out, as you know well, Ukrainians have to be involved in this process, obviously, and other stakeholders in that area. But it does make sense. You know, it does make sense to sit down and say, okay, look, there are various interests here. There are, you know, big divisions in Ukraine. And let's come to a settlement where Russia doesn't feel threatened, where the West can back off gracefully, because it's not the schoolyard of the West here, and they should have known that to begin with, and that a kind of a situation very much like Finland could obtain. There's nothing standing in the way of that, and it would be to the benefit of everyone, first and foremost, the Ukrainians.
Hey, Ray. Sorry to interrupt you, but you keep hitting a button there.
Okay, I got it on a different ear now.
Okay,
sorry.
Good. Yeah, you're beeping on us.
Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Go right ahead. Okay. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm just saying that this is not an intractable situation here. It all needs to happen is for the neoconservatives to say, well, okay, we tried. We tried to reach even more eastward with NATO, and it didn't work. We should take solace in the fact that we caused a lot of poison in the relationship between Russia and the United States. That's all to our good, because maybe Russia won't be so helpful to the United States anymore in preventing things that we want, like U.S. military strike on Syria. So that's the bottom line here. What Victoria Nuland, in passing out those chocolate chip cookies on Independence Square in Kiev, what she was really trying to do was incite what happened, namely the overthrow of the duly elected government, however corrupt it was elected. Yanukovych had to leave. And then, of course, with that incredible intercepted telephone conversation where she tells our U.S. ambassador in Kiev, look, we want Yats. Yats is our guy. The other guys can wait in the waiting room there. They'll come in later, but Yats is our fella. And sure enough, 4 weeks. Yikes! Yats! I don't know what's happening to my.
I don't either.
Yeah, let me see if I can make that not happen. Just a second.
Sure. No problem. Hey, these things happen on the radio show. It's a live show. You know, what are you going to do? No big deal. I just saw on CNN again. They're showing, did we lose them all together? Yeah, we did. I just saw on CNN, they're showing Dmitry Yurash again. I've seen this clip a few times here of Dmitry Yurash, where he's the head of Right Sector. The guys that are ruling the streets of Kiev right now.
Is this Scott?
Yeah, you're on.
Okay. Hopefully it won't happen again. So what I was starting to say is, you know, by all reasonable experience, and I've been around Washington for 50 years now, I confess, when an intercepted conversation like that goes forward, indicating that the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs is plotting a coup against the duly elected government, this time in Ukraine, one would have thought that by any decent standards or respect for the opinions of mankind, that they wouldn't pick the same guy to be the interim prime minister. But what do you find? Yikes, it's Yats. Yatsenyuk comes in as the interim prime minister, and Nuland has already said, well, he's our guy because, you know, he used to be head of the central bank. He knows what the IMF needs, and he'll kind of wean Ukraine into the Western orbit so that the Ukrainian workers can suffer the same fate as the ones in Greece right now, and they'll pay back all their loans with lots of austerity. And sure enough, what Yatsenyuk said, the first thing he got up, he said, you know, I'm prepared to commit political suicide. Everybody's like, what do you mean? I'm prepared to commit political suicide because the austerity measures that I'm going to insist on are going to make it impossible for me to have a political career here. Whoa. So What's afoot here is very transparent. Newland, you know, she's overdone herself, and I think Obama is beginning to realize that these people really don't have U.S. interests at heart. Where are the U.S. interests in the Ukraine other than giving Russia a bloody nose? And why do any people want to make a bloody nose in Moscow? Well, so the Russians won't cooperate with us on issues of more concern to the neoconservatives, and that is Syria. What they would like to see is U.S. military involvement in Syria to prevent Bashar al-Assad from continuing to win.
All right, now wait a minute. Wait. Yeah. I'm so interested in that topic. But before we go that direction with it, are you sure that Ukraine itself and maybe somehow, you know, bringing them into NATO? I mean, rewind a few weeks back before Putin checkmated their sorry asses and everything, but just is it possible their plan really was that, oh no, we're going to do another orange revolution, only it's going to stick this time, and we're really going to separate Ukraine from Russia and maybe even eventually deny them their base in Crimea? Or they just wanted Putin to think that so that he would freak out and cause a crisis, and then that then would lead to the theory you're talking about, that they just wanted to cause a crisis more than they wanted to actually win that influence in Ukraine. Is that what you're saying? Do I have that?
Well, I'm saying, Scott, that it's not an either-or thing. It's a win-win situation. If by some quirk of fate Putin says, well, Ukraine really isn't all that important to me. Yeah, it can join Leighton. It can join NATO. Well, they win. If he says no, in response to some threats from the new Ukrainian leaders saying, you know, maybe we'll kick the Russians out of the Crimea, Putin does what everyone might expect him to do, take back Crimea. Well, they still win, because then there's a poisoned relationship between not only Moscow and Washington, but Moscow and the rest of the Western world. It's not going to last very long, as long as people realize. Now, one thing I'll point out is that there are a couple of European statesmen left in the world, and one of them's name is Helmut Schmidt. Okay, he was the Bundeskanzler, the head of Germany at a time when Bush wanted to have a coalition of the willing to start a war of aggression against Iraq, and Helmut Schmidt put Bush's nose out of joint by saying, "You may have a coalition of the willing, but I am unwilling." Okay. Now, what did Schmidt say to Die Zeit yesterday, one of the major German newspapers? He said, "You know what Putin did was, in his words, durchaus verständlich." Okay, verständlich means understandable. Durchaus means thoroughly. And you know, anybody who would have thought that Putin would have acted any differently would have to have his head examined.
All right, now we'll have to hold it right there and take this dumb break here. But we'll be right back with the great Ray McGovern from RayMcGovern.com right after this. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I'm on the line with Ray McGovern, and we're talking about what's going on in Ukraine. America picked this fight. And, Ray, where we got interrupted by the break, you were talking about how the former chancellor of Germany was saying, come on, man, what do you expect Putin to do, only in German?
Yeah, he said in German, in English, he said this is in Durchaus means thoroughly verständlich, thoroughly understandable. What he's saying is anyone who would have thought that Putin would stand by and let this happen, and particularly would let threats be made to for the new leadership, so to speak, in Ukraine to take over the Crimea or to drive the Russians out of it. You know, the Crimea has been Russia since the Articles of Confederation in this country. It was Catherine the Great at the end of the 18th century, who consolidated Russian rule of that entire area, the Ukraine and Crimea, and that's where the Russian Russian Black Sea Fleet started during her reign, and that's the only really ice-free port that they have, and they can work their influence through the Mediterranean pretty far away from their bases in the Black Sea there at Sevastopol. So it is, you know, Helmut Schmidt is an experienced politician and statesman, and what he said is, what we need is Zusammenarbeit, okay? Zusammen is together. Arbeit, we know, means work. We got to work together. We got to zusammensetzen, okay? We got to sit down together and work this thing out. And, you know, he's speaking for a major ally there in Germany, and I think he's kind of showing up Angela Merkel, who is doing this kind of puppet act where Obama says jump, and she jumps as far as she thinks he wants. And this is running pretty thin in Germany. The Süddeutsche Zeitung, which is the best newspaper, in my view, in Europe, much less in Germany, it's in Munich, and it does a terrific job. It said about 2 months ago, "Ist der Präsident verrückt?" Now, for those of your audience who know what verrückt is, it means crazy, but it means crazy in an incredibly deeper, more pernicious way. If you say, du bist verrückt, that is the supreme insult. And if you give a little sign, it's a finger to the head, not the middle finger, but the index finger, on the Autobahn, that is a criminal offense, because it means du bist verrückt. And it's something you can bring to court and say, this guy called me crazy. So for the establishment paper, this is the establishment paper, the Süddeutsche Zeitung, to pose the question, is der Präsident, and they mean Obama, of course, verrückt? That's a change. That's a sea change in West German or German now attitudes toward the United States. And for the president to continue to rail about sanctions and all this kind of thing, well, Helmut Schmidt said, look, we shouldn't be making threats. We shouldn't be saying sanctions. We should sit down and work this thing out. And again, I think the Finland example is exactly what would fit here. Nobody would lose. And especially the Ukrainians would have a decent chance at a new life. The problem with the Ukrainians, of course, is that they never had a chance at democracy. They never had a chance to cultivate real leaders. And so when they broke away from the Soviet Union, it was the oligarchs. It was the smart people who made the money and were cultivated by U.S. smart people with lots of money. And the corruption was rife. But the West got in there big time. This time, Monsanto better give up its idea of selling its corrupt seeds to corrupt people to cultivate the black earth, which is the breadbasket of that part of Europe, because it ain't going to happen. And Putin's going to make sure it doesn't happen. What needs to happen is for an accommodation to be worked out. And this is not a difficult one. It's simply that the neocons overreached themselves. As I said in my first article on this, this was one regime change too far. And they better just sit down and work it out.
All right, now, but, okay, a couple things. Well, three things. First of all, is that going to happen here? Is the Obama administration actually going to negotiate anything or have the UN intervene for them and negotiate or call Joe Biden or whatever it is? And then secondly, what about the Nazis, Svoboda and Right Sector? How big of a deal is this really? And then thirdly, we still got to talk about before the top of the hour, Dianne Feinstein and the Senate Intelligence Committee versus the CIA. I got to hear what you have to say about that. So talk fast.
Yeah. Well, it will be worked out. We have the president already backing off, you know. He's saying, I'm less concerned about Russian troops than I am about a nuke going off in Manhattan. Well, you know, that's the byword here. Terrorism is what we're concerned about, not the Russian troops in Ukraine. Although, you know, the pundits and the strong anti-Soviet, anti-Russian people continue to beat the drums. So he's also said, and it was today, that we're not thinking about more damaging sanctions right now. unless he goes further, unless he goes into the eastern Ukraine or that kind of thing. So I think it'll be worked out. It's just going to take a lot of time, and it's going to create a lot of temporary damage between the capitals, the Moscow and Washington, and that, of course, was part of the aim of the people like prima donna Neokana Victoria Nuland.
All right, and then, so now, I can't find the tweet. I thought I had retweeted it, but I did have a link here to a massive right sector protest where they're demanding, it looked like a pretty big protest there, where they're demanding the resignation of one minister or another. And then there's this article running at antiwar.com today about how the right sector guys, who are, you know, people have called them the brown shirts, how they're the police of Kiev. They have seized the city of Kiev. This one is, it centers on the story of a Swede who's also a Nazi who's traveled to help chip in with these guys. And they've gotten from, what, 5 to 8 high-level positions in the new government. And so what about all of that?
Well, that's a real and present danger, and it's partly due to the messing with the internal affairs there by our celebrated National Endowment for Democracy, which is really the successor to the covert action staff of the CIA. There are neo-Nazis there, and there's incredibly bitter feeling between Russians and those neo-Nazis because they remember Bandera and the rest of them, that when the Germans came into the Soviet Union in 1941, who cooperated? Who actually rounded up not only Jews but Ukrainians and others and sent them off to Auschwitz and other places like that? So there's terrific bad feeling there. And why Victoria Nuland and other people thought that they could work with this crowd? You know, the enemy of the enemy is my friend. Give me a break. I don't want friends like these.
Yeah, not always, guys. Just maybe, could be in some circumstances. What the hell kind of rule of thumb is that? All right, and now real quickly here, you're a former CIA officer, so certainly you're taking their side against the evil Senate committee trying to stop, trying to tell the truth about their torture program, right? No.
Provocateur. Not at all. You know, this is very serious business. This is the torture, okay? This is something that the U.S. never descended to before. John Brennan and the people at CIA are still in control, and they are equally guilty of being part of all this. And so small wonder that they would not want to share the real deal, the real information on all this. And so what they've done is spied on the Senate Intelligence Committee and withdrawn some of the incredibly damaging revelations about waterboarding and so forth. It's no surprise to do that. What is surprising is that all of a sudden, Dianne Feinstein, who's been first and foremost a supporter not only of NSA but of the CIA, all of a sudden she gets in high dudgeon. She gets up without warning and says, "Hey, they're spying on me. They're accusing my young people who did this wonderful study of perpetrating a crime." Now, how do you explain that? Well, you know, some people say, well, some people see the light all too late, but then they finally see it. But I think it's more of a matter of emotion here. She's got these young people working for her, right? Uh-huh. They're grandchildren, really, and for her age. And all of a sudden, they're accused of a crime. That sort of ticks her off. Now, who's going to win on this? She's not going to win. Obama is much more afraid of John Brennan and his coterie of torturers over there than he is of Grandma Feinstein. So what I predict, this will end up in not a beer summit, because Feinstein's from California, of course. It'll be a wine summit, and she'll get together with John Brennan, and they'll have some wine, and it will all be papered over. Now,
doesn't that show where we are, though, where the CIA thinks they're more than an equal to the U.S. Senate?
Well, that's a sad commentary on all this, isn't it? But that's what we have. We have security services, we have the media, we have the corporations. That's very close to the definition of fascism.
That's Ray McGovern, everybody. RayMcGovern.com and ConsortiumNews.com. Thanks very much, Ray. Appreciate it.
You're most welcome, Scott.
And that's the show. We'll see you guys tomorrow. Thanks very much for listening. scotthorton.org for the archives.